This audio is a recording of the Irish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign public meeting, Gaza After the Flotilla, What Next? The speakers are Fintan Lane, who was on the Challenger 1, and Derek Graham, who was on the Rachel Corrie. The audio was recorded on the 12th of June 2010.
Now, the first speaker was somebody who, somebody who I was worried was dead, shot. Because initial Israeli media reports were telling us that 19 people had been killed. Among them, an Irish person had been either killed or wounded. And of course, this is what Israel always does when it perpetrates a massacre. It spreads uncertainty, spreads fear, and spreads these terrible worries among everybody. Among not just the victims, but among everybody who knows anybody who was involved in these things. So I'm extremely happy that he wasn't shot, wounded, or anything else. So I'm very happy to present for the first speaker, Fintan Lane. Let's give him a big hand.
I'm here as a witness to what happened in the flotilla, so I think it's only right that I recount my own experiences. But after I've done that, I want to talk for a little bit about what people should do in terms of ongoing Palestine solidarity work, because, I mean, there's much that people can do, particularly through the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. In terms of the flotilla, for those of us that were involved, I think the objective was twofold. It was to bring aid to Gaza, to bring goods that had been banned by the Israelis. Simple goods, bags of cement, for instance, that they're not allowed to bring in order to help in reconstruction work. Now, bear in mind that Gaza was destroyed back in 2008, 2009, when the Israelis massacred and they killed 1,400 people, including 300 children. Much of the infrastructure was destroyed. Simple things to allow them to reconstruct, such as bags of cement and other construction materials, are banned, as are medical equipment, various types of medical equipment. And until the day before yesterday, they had banned bags of crisps and sweets. This is how bad the Israeli blockade is. It's a punitive collective punishment on the entire people of Gaza. So the mission was to stand in solidarity with the people of Gaza, to support their resistance, and also to bring aid. Now, when we set off from Crete on Thursday morning, and we were full of hope. We were determined to get to Gaza, as was everybody else in the flotilla. We headed first to Cyprus. We intended there to pick up some passengers, including a number of Irish parliamentarians. However, the Israelis had put pressure on the Cypriot authorities. The consequence of that was when, as we neared Cypriot waters, we were approached by a Cypriot police helicopter, and we were told in no uncertain terms that we were not welcome within Cypriot waters, and it was clear to us that we could not pick up passengers at that stage. We moved further up the coast. We needed to refuel. There were a couple of technical difficulties with the bilge on the boat, and we needed to go into some port. So we were forced to go into Famagusta in northern Cyprus. That's the Turkish-occupied northern Cyprus. We got a very warm reception from the authorities. The mayor of the town sent us lots and lots of food because we had been running low on food, and we received visitors to the dock, and we weren't allowed to disembark. But we did receive a warm reception. However, as the day moved on, it became clear to us that the Turkish authorities in northern Cyprus were under similar pressure to those in the south. Now, personally, I think it's because of negotiations that are ongoing for unity between north and south Cyprus. They don't want to piss off the southern Cypriots. Consequently, when we were told by the southern Cypriots that we couldn't go into any port, the people in the north realised that they could have a diplomatic incident on their hands if they allowed us to take people on board. So within a short period of time, it became clear that one, we weren't going to be allowed to take on passengers, and two, we weren't actually going to be allowed leave. We were impounded. There was a lot of negotiations over the next number of hours. We were in a bubble at that stage. We didn't know what was happening, but we were told by the flotilla that they would wait for us. And they waited for us out in the Mediterranean. That was said to us repeatedly. Don't worry, nobody's going anywhere until Challenger 1 has left Cyprus and joins us. The pressure eventually worked, but only three people were allowed to board. A famous Swedish novelist, a member of the Swedish Parliament, and a doctor. But nonetheless, we were delighted that we were allowed to leave. Very unhappy that certain people, such as Caoimhe Butterly and various others, weren't allowed to board the boat. We headed for the flotilla, which was well out in the Mediterranean at this stage, and it was night time, 2 o'clock in the morning by the time we met the other ships. Now, I have to say, it was a wonderful sight, because we asked them to light up, to basically alert us to their whereabouts. I mean, obviously, the captain was able to navigate, but it helped to have the lights on. So when we approached the flotilla, these ships were lit up across the horizon, and it was a magnificent sight. It really was. We anchored and waited to the following day to move off. And when we woke up the following morning, we saw the ships spread across us. And we're talking about a serious flotilla here of large ships. Large Turkish passenger ship, large Greek passenger ship, and a number of cargo vessels. And it really, really looked impressive. And I have to say, we felt elated as the ships moved off on Sunday in the direction of Gaza. It seemed to us that something serious was afoot, and that, I mean, we knew that the Israelis were likely to intervene, but there was a determination there, and there was a sense of purpose, a sense of unity. We expected to get to Gaza on Monday morning at daylight. I think that the ETA was something like 11 o'clock, I'm not sure exactly.
11.
It was 11, was it? Yeah. We expected to get there during the daylight hours. At some stage, however, during the night, we began to realise that there was activity around us. Radars on the various ships began to pick up unidentified vessels at various positions. We saw lights occasionally, but mostly it was darkness and we couldn't see what ships were near us. But after a while, it became clear that there were Israeli naval vessels in the area. We were being circled. I think it was around 12 o'clock, I'm not sure the exact time, when the Israeli Navy made contact with the Challenger 1, and which is the boat I was on, and the large Turkish ship, and perhaps others, identifying themselves as a warship and asking us not to proceed to Gaza. Needless to say, that was ignored. We were well out in international waters, and our purpose was clear. We intended to break the blockade of Gaza, and we expected some resistance from the Israelis, and we treated it with we ignored it. I mean, we steamed ahead. Nonetheless, because we were aware of an Israeli presence, we posted lookouts around the boat, and we on our boat, Challenger 1, worked out a strategy of defence. We decided we would resist a boarding party. We decided that we would make it a practical resistance, that the objective should be to defend the journalists on board, to give them time to upload the footage they were taking of the attack on the boat and any other photographs or footage they might have. Now, in terms of the boat itself, Challenger 1 had 17 people on board, 12 passengers, 5 crew. There were 4 people from Ireland, Fiacre O'Loon here, myself, Shane Dillon, and Paul McGough, who's a journalist from the Sunday Morning Herald. Our strategy, as I said, was to defend the boat, to allow the journalists time to upload or to hide their photographs and footage. And we built a barricade on the deck area of the boat, because we decided that the obvious points of entrance were they would go for the fly deck, which was where the captain was steering the boat from. That's up above the main cabin. And they would also go for the deck area at the back. So we built a barricade at the deck area. We put buoys on the sides of the boat to impede their access along the side. We locked all the doors to the outside, with the exception of the back door, which is a backsliding door. And we kept an eye out in anticipation of an Israeli attack. Now, even though we realised they were in the area, I think many of the passengers were still convinced that they would not attack until we were closer to Gazan waters. when they did attack, I think it was 4 o'clock, between 4 and 4:30. I'm not sure the exact time. We weren't looking at our watches. It came very suddenly, and it was an attack on all ships at the same time. And the tactics used were a miniature version of shock and awe. The intent clearly was to overcome resistance as quickly as possible with as much violence as they deemed necessary. We were told shortly before we were attacked, I think it was sometime before, maybe half an hour beforehand, that there was a ship that the Turkish captain radioed our captain and informed us that there was an Israeli vessel or an unidentified vessel heading directly from us, from the left-hand side, and that there was a lot of activity. Now, we could see nothing. It was pitch black. So we were, at this stage, on a high state of alert. And eventually we spotted Zodiacs carrying Israeli commandos come to our side, to the back of the boat. Now, the commandos obviously were dressed entirely in black. The Zodiacs are black. The intention was to just come out of the night and surprise us and take us as quickly as possible. However, because we spotted them, the captain was able to put the foot down and a chase ensued. We took off at high speed with Zodiacs chasing us on all sides. We passed the Turkish ship on the left-hand side of the Turkish ship as they were being engaged by the Israelis. Some of the Zodiacs on our right-hand side peeled off to engage with that attack. We saw the Turks using low-pressure hoses to fend off the Zodiacs. We saw a helicopter overhead. We heard shots. We heard stun grenades going off. We carried on past the ship. The photographers on the photographer Kate Geraghty on the top deck actually took some very nice photographs of the attack on the Turkish ship. One of those photographs was published in last weekend's weekend section of the Irish Times. And, you know, that had to be smuggled out, which I'll get to later. But we took off at high speed, and we were followed closely by the Zodiacs. The wake on our boat kept the Zodiacs away. They couldn't board as a result of the speed we were going at and the wake that was being produced by the boat. I mean, I think we were probably the fastest boat in the flotilla. Eventually, however, I think it was after... We actually shook them. The Zodiacs pulled back at one stage and they gave up the chase. Or so it seemed to us. They clearly pulled back and just melted into the night. I think it might have been 20 minutes later or thereabouts when a bright light began moving directly across in front of us. And it moved in our direction. And it was clear to us that we were in danger of being rammed. It seemed that there was an Israeli naval ship, a larger vessel, on a collision course. Our captain, Dennis Healy, slowed the boat down, and as soon as the boat slowed down to avoid being rammed, the Zodiacs came in on top of us. We immediately reacted by adding to the barricade at the back to close off the holes that we had in it, because we'd been out as lookouts, but we got behind the barricade, called on people to get back into the main cabin, and at that stage, before they actually got on the boat, they hurled a stun grenade, which exploded where that is from me, as I was trying to close. They were clearly trying to stop me from closing the door at the back, the backsliding door. It exploded, big bang, flash, smoke, whatever. Nonetheless, I got the backsliding door closed and locked it down. We immediately then lifted a heavy table inside the cabin area to further impede them, which was just as well, because they were certainly slowed down by the locking of the door, but they weren't slowed down that much because they used their rifles to smash open the glass. They came through the glass to smash windows in the boat, and they came through. We pushed the table on top of them. We pushed all the furniture in their way, and we did various things to impede their progress with furniture and so on. The American journalist who was downstairs at that stage had gone into he was inside in the wheelhouse, and to further impede his progress, myself and one other person got into the passageway, and we crouched to block their entrance there. basically, they stomped all over us and they used us as if we were part of the carpet. And we nonetheless, you know, did our best to continue to impede them, to slow their progress down. One of the soldiers grabbed me. There was a rifle put in my face. I was told that I would be shot unless I moved a few inches. I believed it. I mean, I believed him. These guys were very agitated. They were at this stage. They were basically assaulting anybody who attempted to impede them. This guy was really worked up, and I have to say, I was very shocked by the deaths on the Turkish ship, but the violence that was used to take the Challenger 1 was of such an extent that I wasn't surprised by the deaths on the larger ship. It was inevitable that any resistance was going to be put down violently. I could hear screams outside on the back deck where they had Huwaida, a Palestinian activist, member of the Free Gaza movement, and she was screaming as she was resisting. They assaulted everybody in some fashion. They got to the fly deck and they tasered Kate Geraghty, the photojournalist from the Sydney Morning Herald. On the side deck, they fired a plastic bullet or something into the face of Greet, a Belgian girl, caused serious damage to her nose and bloodied her nose. And, you know, basically they used as much violence as they felt necessary to subdue those on board. There were probably 20 or more commandos, and this is to take on perhaps 17 humanitarian political activists. Huwaida and I think one other were brought to the front of the boat where they had plastic ties put on their hands. They had to kneel down, and there was a hood put over Huwaida's head, and Anna, the other girl, had a blindfold put on her. We were held at gunpoint within the cabin itself. From the outset, we weren't compliant kidnappees. I made it very clear, myself, as did others, that we considered what they were doing to be illegal, that it was in international waters, that they were not welcome on board, and that we wanted them off the ship. They didn't comply with that suggestion, but we repeated it many times. We refused to cooperate, and we basically articulated our opposition to what they had done throughout the journey to Israel. One of the first things they did once they had control of the boat was to search for all recording devices, cameras and telephones, and they stole everything. And when I say they stole everything, what I mean by that is we've got nothing back. They even took the equipment belonging to the journalists, although personally I think, you know, it's just as wrong that they took my phones, but you know, I suppose journalists are special, so we'll give them a plug. They did. I mean, the journalists were there as neutral parties, and nonetheless, they were treated the same as the rest of us. I mean, they were brought to prison in Israel, and they were treated as badly as anybody else. We were brought to Israel, and prior to them bringing us off the boat, in fact, before we arrived in the port, we made it clear to them that we did not want to enter Israel and that we did not want to leave the ship. When they docked, prior to docking, I think this is interesting in terms of the mindset of the Israeli PR machine. Prior to going into the port, one of the commandos went out with a brush and started cleaning up the debris from the deck outside. They also closed all the curtains because they didn't want anybody to film or photograph the damage they had done to the boat. And I mean, basically, they wrecked the place. They would not make good house guests. They just destroyed the boat in the process of taking it, causing a fair bit of damage to the windows and so on. But that was all cleaned up for the cameras. And the curtains were closed, so we couldn't be seen. We articulated our opposition to being brought to Israel. I pointed out to them that we wanted to go to Gaza, that we did not want to get off in Israel. And when the boat docked, we linked arms and we refused to leave the boat. We were all taken off individually by force. I was grabbed by four commandos and wrestled away from everybody else, dragged across the cabin and out the door, all the time protesting that I did not want to leave the boat and I did not want to enter Israel and that they were kidnappers. On the dock, I was handed over to two policemen. In front of us were a couple of hundred naval and military personnel, clearly off duty, who, I mean, God knows what the purpose of it was. Maybe they were just asked to fill the place up for I don't know what the reason for it was, but they stood there with their cameras and their video cameras taking footage and photographs of us as we were brought off. I can only recall my own personal experience of this, although I did see other people being brought off the boat. Ava, actually, a Polish-British Free Gaza activist, I saw her in the detention centre, and she actually refused she just played dead and refused to assist them in any sense. So I saw her levitating through the processing area because they had to lift her all the way from the boat with her legs up under her and into the processing area and lift her from one desk to another. Anyway, with regard to myself, I was brought into the processing area and confronted by these people from, I don't know, immigration, Mossad, take your pick, who asked me to present my passport. I refused. My passport was in my top pocket here, but I refused, as I had done on the boat, I refused repeatedly to give them my passport on the basis that I was under no obligation to cooperate with kidnappers. I pointed this out to them again within the processing area. I said that I had been kidnapped in international waters by armed men, brought to a country that I did not want to go to. I felt under no obligation to cooperate with them, and I wouldn't be cooperating with them. I wouldn't sign anything. I wouldn't answer their questions. And that was the attitude I would be taking. So I was grabbed by two security men. I had my arm twisted high behind my back, which hurt considerably. They then removed the passport from my pocket. I continued to refuse to cooperate, and I was brought through, I don't know, five or six different desks where I was asked various questions, and I refused to sign anything or answer their questions. The most surreal moment, I think, has to be when they told me that I was going to be charged with illegally entering Israel, and that the penalty for this was deportation. At that moment, I came very close to describing them, calling them half-wits, but I was intent on remaining calm, and apart from a laugh, I pointed out that, you know, the contrary was true, that in fact I'd been illegally kidnapped and brought to Israel against my will by force. I refused to sign the deportation form, and the consequence of that was, with everybody else, with the others, I was brought to a prison in Beersheba in southern Israel. And we were denied contact with the outside world. We weren't allowed contact with our embassies. We weren't allowed phone calls. And it's quite clear that eventually the consular assistance that we received only happened because of the international outcry. We had some inkling at that stage of what had happened on the Turkish ship, because a soldier had said to Ava in the processing centre that they were dead on the ship. And obviously, people were... It was shocking. I mean, shocking, but as I said, not surprising because of the force they used. As the wing began to fill up with prisoners from the other ships, we got more stories, and we saw some of the injuries from the Turkish ship and from other ships. The people were badly beaten on a number of the ships, on the Greek ship, for instance, as well. One gentleman from the Turkish ship lifted his T-shirt and showed me a bite mark on his stomach where he'd been savagely bitten by an Israeli dog. Other people had head wounds. There were stories of people, of dead bodies on the deck with bullet holes in their forehead. It was clearly hell on that Turkish ship. There's no question about that. So I think we were somber because of that, but we were also more determined within the prison, we did not accept the authority of the prison officers. Repeatedly told them that we just refused to cooperate with them, and told them that we considered ourselves to be political prisoners and kidnap victims. We, in fact, there was a committee set up to represent the prisoners. I was on that committee, which didn't last too long because we were only in there 2.5 days, I think, really, in the prison. We put a set of demands. The first demand was access to the to embassy officials. And that happened the following day. So we weren't cooperative in any sense at all, and I think we were right not to be. Eventually, we were brought to when international pressure forced them to release us. We were brought to the airport, and there was an air of menace in the airport. I myself wasn't assaulted at the airport, but other people were. We were on the ground on the tarmac for maybe 10-12 hours. While there was a standoff, Turkish Airways and the Turkish government refused to allow the planes to take off until everybody was released and until everybody was on the plane, on the planes, which was the correct attitude to take. After a while, people began to come on the plane with what looked like broken fingers, black eyes, etc., etc. And it's clear that they had begun to assault people in the airport terminal. Fikra, who's over here, was assaulted by the military inside there. I think between 10 and 20 personnel jumped in him and gave him a savage beating. Ken O'Keefe, another Irish passport holder, was given a bad beating. Several others were badly beaten. And I was told by one of the women from our ship that they were backslapping people as they were going up the staircase inside, and she was hit as she was going up. They basically were giving them hard slaps to the back of the head. So they were intent on underlining the Israeli hospitality and their unwelcome for us. But I have to say, once we were on the Turkish plane, we felt that ultimately we were safe and we would leave. Now, the deaths of those 9 Turkish people is a tragedy, and I don't think in any way we can describe what happened as a success. It wasn't a success. It was a tragedy. It was a tragedy that will have good results, I think. It may be a game changer if we ensure that it's a game changer. The international media focused on Gaza as a result of what happened. I find elements of it a little bit disturbing, I have to say, because it was right that the world's media focused on the deaths of those 9 brave people, who, by the way, the talk about violence on the Turkish ship, if anybody wants to ask me a question about this afterwards, I'll go into some detail in it, but let me be clear about this. When you're attacked by armed men in international waters, you are entitled to defend yourself. That said, there were no weapons on that ship, as the Israelis described them. There were no guns. There were nothing like that. But people did defend themselves. They disarmed some of the Israelis and threw guns overboard. They in some instances, fought back. I applaud those people. I think any reference to those... So where do we go from here? What I was going to say, by the way, was I'm not disturbed by the focus on the deaths of the Turkish people. I am disturbed, however, by the lack of focus on an ongoing basis on the deaths of Palestinians. There's almost a racism there. There's a sense in which the Palestinians are expected to die. The people of Gaza are expected to suffer. And we've got to ensure that changes. Now, where do we go from here? There are a number of things happening in the near future. We will sail again, and I will be on the next flotilla, if at all possible. There was a meeting in Istanbul on Wednesday by those who were involved in organising the last flotilla. The intention is to get something going within the next number of weeks, possibly September. It's not clear when yet. But there will be another, and hopefully a much larger, flotilla. So this is not going away. The objective to end the siege of Gaza is not a long-term objective, it's not a medium-term objective, it is a short-term objective. The siege of Gaza must be ended soon. With regard to people here, what do you do? I mean, how do you get involved in helping, in standing in solidarity with the people of Palestine? And I'm not speaking simply about the people of Gaza. What's happening in the West Bank needs to be focused on as well. We're talking about Gaza, or sorry, Palestine as a whole. There are two things I would ask people to do. Get involved in the campaign for BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions. The Irish Congress of Trade Unions has come out fully and behind that campaign. Hopefully we see the trade unions mobilised to black Israeli products. On an individual basis, you can refuse to buy Israeli goods. As a consumer, you can engage in a consumer boycott. And call on the Irish government, write to the Irish government, contact Micheál Martin, and ask them to take the lead in demanding that the EU take sanctions against Israel. Israel must be treated as the apartheid state it is. It must be treated in the way that apartheid South Africa was. It must be isolated as the rogue state it is and forced to accept the Palestinian right to self-determination. The other thing that I would really ask people to do is to become active. The fact that you're here shows that you care. But I would like, really like people to move beyond that to action. Get involved in the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. The IPSC is the leading Palestine solidarity organisation in this country. It organises a range of activities from supporting the flotillas to organising the BDS campaign in Ireland. It is involved in anything. It is involved in every form of action. It engages in a diversity of actions to help stand in solidarity with the resistance in Palestine. And I would encourage everybody here to go up to that table afterwards and sign up to the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you.
I articulated my opposition. That has to be one of the big understatements of the day. When the other ships, the flotilla, was being attacked, we were wondering what was the Rachel Curry going to be doing about it. I have to say, I assumed as soon as they heard that Israel had done what it had done, they would stop. But they didn't. With incredible bravery, they kept their course straight for Gaza. And I just want to applaud that bravery. I'm really, to be honest, honoured to introduce the next speaker, who's one of the owners of the Rachel Curry, and who was on that ship, Derek Graham. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll give you a brief history first of which is the ship. The ship was in Dundalk. It had been arrested in Dundalk. And we bought it at auction on the 30th of March. At that stage, there was a lot of work to be done with it, but we wanted to have basically an Irish ship with Irish aid going to Gaza with this flotilla. So we bought the ship with the help of the Malaysians, a group called Perdana, and we got the whole thing ready and we set sail. We got, I think, 550 tonne of quince mint. We got educational equipment from Norway, paper, we got educational equipment, medical equipment and children's toys for orphanages and special needs kids. So we had the whole ship loaded up and we headed off. Now, knowing the situation and the way it was in Cyprus, we basically kept telling everybody that we're going to first be bunkering in Ceuta, part of Spain, and then that we'd be coming to Cyprus and we'd be picking up things. Now, that's the story that we had out there for everybody, and everybody actually had it, because like, we knew that we were going to be trying to stop us. Best thing for them to do is stop you import, so then they don't have to, we'd say, deal with any bad publicity. So we just got down to Ceuta, drove straight by, and went to Malta. Got in on a Sunday night, bunkered up, took extra fuel, and that's where we said all the passengers got on board, and then we just headed straight from there to Gaza. We left Malta at around 12 o'clock on Sunday night, midnight Sunday night, and I think it was around 4 hours later we started getting phone calls about what had happened. and what was happening and everything else. So we, everybody on board, sat down, we had a meeting, decide what we want to do. First, we had a minute's silence for everybody, and then, because the information was so sketchy, it was anywhere between 2 and 20 people dead. We didn't know any, we had no information at all. So we sat down and we had this meeting, and everybody on board that boat was more determined than ever to continue on. If we had turned around, we, the way we looked at it was, these people died in vain and we'd only be insulting their memories. So we continued on. We were getting a lot of media attention. There was a lot of media phoning, wanting to know why the hell would we do, why the hell would we want to do this. And the media was very ignorant of the whole situation in Gaza. And that really amazed me. They were asking, like, I mean, every time they'd ask, they'd say, have you got banned items on board? And we said, of course we have. We said, we have things, very dangerous things, like children's toys. And there was kind of, what? And you're going to go, children's toys are banned. Paper is banned. The media didn't know this. And, I mean, I think that's, it's a sad thing to say. I mean, that the media should be actually investigating this and getting it out there, but they're not. So anyway, we continued on, and we're getting closer and closer. Now, she's not the fastest boat in the world, so you're not going to make a run for it. So about, you could see people on board, and they were getting more and more anxious the further we were going. And on this Friday night, we were basically, I don't think anybody slept. We were answering the phones in shifts, and we were just kind of keeping an eye out. Now, we knew, we could see on our radar that we had been shadowed from about, I'd say, 1 o'clock in the morning. We were being shadowed. And we knew, normally, they won't attack until the break of day. But because of what happened with the Turkish ship and the rest of the flotilla, that plan was gone out the window. So people were continuously watching. About 5 o'clock in the morning, still dark, the one boat came right in, we'd say, tight to us, and then started jamming in all the equipment. Then we lost, we'd say, radar equipment, navigation equipment. We started losing different parts, satellite phones, communication. We lost everything. So we were basically travelling there at that stage by ourselves with no access to the outside world. Then a second, much larger vessel came along, and then they started talking to us. They refused to call the boat the Rachel Corrie. They continuously called it the MV Linda, which was the previous name. And every time you'd correct them, and every time they'd still keep calling it the Linda. So, because they didn't, I refused to come off Channel 16. Channel 16 is the international emergency channel. And I refused to come off that channel because then at that stage, every other vessel in that region can hear the conversation. And that was our only way of getting what was happening out to the rest of the world. They decided, at one stage, they decided they were going to board. And, I mean, these negotiations were going on from maybe around 6 o'clock until 11 o'clock. And they said they were going to board. At this stage, now, we had turned off our engines and we were sitting just adrift in the water. We've seen about 6 Zodiacs, you know, coming up from behind. And as they were approaching, I just turned around to them. I said, you do realise that we are in international waters. We have not violated any Israeli waters, any Israeli laws, any maritime laws. I says, we are sitting at sea having a peaceful protest. All of a sudden, you're seeing the Zodiac stopping, and it was kind of, I'll get back to you. There was about 40 minutes of kind of complete silence from them, where they must have been in onto the government saying, okay, what do we do? We are in international waters. And then after about 40 minutes, it was kind of, okay, we're still coming. And I kept repeating, we are in international waters. We have not violated Israeli waters. We have not violated Israeli law. We have not violated any maritime laws. We're sitting there having a peaceful protest. Man just basically says, sorry, Derek, they're coming anyway. At that stage, I got everybody to midships. The Israelis had ordered me to have everybody to midships because I didn't want a repeat of what had happened. You have to remember that on board the Rachel Corrie, we had 11 activists, but we also had 8 crew members, and the crew were not activists. They were just paid professional crew. And, yes, we told them where they were going, most of them actually had to look up where Gaza was. But they started reading about it, and then they kind of said, yeah, okay, we're prepared to do that, yeah, and it's only humanitarian aid, yeah, we've no problem there. And I didn't want them to get injured. I mean, because they were, we'd say, they were brought in kind of sideways, if you know what I mean. So they'd ordered me to get everybody to midships. I had everybody in midships, and they'd ordered me to stay on the bridge. Now, at that stage, that was about the only part where I was starting to get kind of pretty worried, because you had a full platoon, about 35 guys come on board, each one carrying three weapons, tasers, stun grenades, and knives, for 19 people that hadn't got anything between them, that and a stick even between them. So at that stage, you're getting a bit worried. They came on board, they set up, both six of them set up, I mean, their weapons with their bipods, dropped down the bipods, and because I'm standing at the in the wheelhouse, they just aimed them all up at me. So I'm standing there with my hands against the glass to show them I have nothing in my hands to show that, I mean, I was just peaceful, I'm here, look, don't bother shooting. One of the funniest, actually, things that happened was I had six rifles pointing at me. I'm standing here like this, and then the radio goes, Israeli Navy calling the Linda, and I'm kind of going, I'm fucked if I'm putting my hand down there and picking up something and going, I'll leave that one, I'll leave that call. But they worked their way up through the boats, they took everybody else, got them sitting down, searched them, took all their recording equipment, cameras, everything else off them as well. And then they worked their way up to me, told me to get face down on the floor, put my hands behind my head. I'd done that, then cable tied me, brought me around the back of the boat, put me kneeling down for about 3/4 of an hour, just facing the wall. Every time you do that, it was kind of face the wall, shut up, don't talk, nothing like that, the usual. So at that stage, would say I hadn't seen anybody else from, because I had been completely separated from everybody else, but eventually they cut the cable ties and let me go in with the rest of the crew. So we were brought into Ashdod, and one of the saddest sights was brought into Ashdod, we were parked behind the whole flotilla. So you were just looking at this line of aid ships and peace activist boats, and they're just all in one line, and you can actually see the damage that's on them, and when then we're parked in behind them. And like that, you had all these soldiers, standing around quayside as well. And they got the activists off first, and then all the soldiers started to come down. And the strange thing, all the people on board are on the quayside, all started to go, yeah, great job, lads. And I'm kind of turning around, and I look at the guy that's kind of minding me. I says, they're for fucking real. And he's going, shut up, get on. And I'm kind of going, it was surreal. I mean, you had 19 people, send 35 guys on board, fully armed, to take 19 people that haven't got anything between them, and then they're getting this kind of hero's welcome when they get in. It was really strange. So we got it, we were brought in. Ginny, my wife, she was strip searched at the quayside. All that was basically a curtain, nothing else. And she was strip searched. The rest of us were all searched as well, and any other stuff they could get, they took off us. We still haven't received any of that back either, even though I've asked the Israeli embassy for it. They said they're looking into it. They also asked for the ship. They said they're looking into that too. Then we were brought to the processing centre, to the same one as maybe you were brought to, same processing centre, and more or less the same thing. Signed this, and it was kind of, what is it? It's in Hebrew. So it's kind of, you're asking, what is it? You know, it's to say that you're in Israel illegally. And I says, yes, I am. And they're kind of, and I says, yes, I says, you brought me here illegally. I says, I was in international waters. You put a gun in my face and you brought me here. I says, I'm not signing that. And if you don't sign that, you're going to go to prison. And I says, grand, but I'm not signing it. And they're kind of going, you're going to go to prison. And I says, look, I know the amount of bad publicity you've got, you want me out of here as fast as possible. You're not going to be keeping me in prison. And your one got really antsy at that thing. Kind of, oh, you think you're a lawyer? And I says, no, but I know you want me out of here. And it was kind of, so the, basically they got, which said everybody refused to sign. We're brought to Ben Gurion Detention Centre, and we were held there for approximately 2 days. And we were shipped back here, then back to, basically back to Ireland. But it, I mean, to go back to the part we say the trip between when we heard the news and we'd say when, between we were arrested. The information that was coming out was so sporadic and so all over the place, it was just mind-boggling. We had absolutely no idea, because all we were doing, we were getting it from satellite phones, and the number was going up, it was going down. We had no idea who was on board. You have to remember that I would know a lot of the captains of all the ships, and that's why I was worried, because I had heard a story that the captain of the Marmara had basically got a bullet between the two eyes, and I'm standing there with my two hands. So then at that stage, that's when I was starting to get worried. Now, it turned out that that was false, but saying that, I've seen footage since. One guy was basically executed. He was shot four times in the head and once in the back at a range of 45 centimetres. That's about 45 centimetres. And he was shot four times in the head and once in the back. So, I mean, what happened there was way over the top, and like, I mean, I would hold the Minister for Defence, Chief of Staff and the Head of the Navy completely responsible for that, because that was a massacre. And I think, but for the grace of God, there could have been a lot more people dead. I mean, they just went in there opening fire randomly at whoever. If you stood up, you got shot at, and that was the way it seemed to work. I just want to talk about Gaza for a minute, because, I mean, that is the thing that an awful lot of people have forgotten about in this whole story. On average, there's about 9 people every day dying in Gaza, and this never makes the paper. Gaza is, in Gaza, what the Israelis are doing is a slow form of genocide. That's the easiest and simplest way that you can put it. But they're doing it in such a way that it's actually, it can't be ever reported as genocide. The sewage system, we'd say, hasn't worked there for 3 years. So now you have 1.5 million people's raw sewage going out into the sea. Now, the fishermen, there's no food getting in. There's only 20% of what should be getting in. So there's no food getting in. The fishermen go out. If they go out past 2 miles, they're shot. So they have to fish inside 2 miles, which is heavily, heavily polluted water. I've seen them spending longer taking sewage out of their nets than fish. If you have nothing else to eat and you see your kids are hungry, you're going to feed them this. Even though you know it's going to cause them harm in the long run, you're keeping them alive in the short term. And the Palestinians know this. They eat this fish. You eat it long enough, you're going to end up with stomach complaints. You go to the hospital, there's no medical facilities in the hospital to treat it. So these people die. But they die of natural causes. Because down the death certificate as natural causes are, do you mean, stomach complaints. It's not that they were shot by the Israelis or anything else like that. So these people don't count. They're just dying of natural causes. But it's a slow form of genocide. The same with the farmers. I've seen, and there's footage of farmers, the Israelis decided they wanted a buffer zone between Israel and Gaza. So they put a 300 metre buffer zone between them. They put it on the Gazan side rather than the Israeli side, which that took 25% of their agricultural land out of operations. If the farmers go in there, they're shot at. The soldiers actually just play a game between themselves out of boredom. See who can shoot as close as they can to the farmer without hitting them. And by the way, if you hit them, so what? You lose. You owe me a cigarette. That kind of thing. And it's absolutely scandalous. And we've activists on the ground in there to go out and actually accompany the farmers, get footage of this, and we have footage of them just shooting at the farmers for no reason. Old men and women, they're out in the fields just trying to till the land, and they're just been shot. You have a water system in there that hasn't been fully operational for years. You have an electricity system in there that gets 4 hours electricity a day on a good day. That's what you have, 4 hours of electricity. And that's the parts that are still operational. The whole thing in there is an absolute scandal. Like, the hospitals were bombed, which should never have happened in any war, and they haven't been rebuilt because no reconstruction material gets in. There's people still living in tents 18 months after a war. It's scandalous. You had the Msouni family down in Rafah. They were all rounded up and told, listen, during that war, they were rounded up, put into a house and says, listen, we're going, the Israeli says, we're going bombing this area, get all the family, put them into this house here, and you should be safe. That was the only house they bombed, killing 31 of them. It's scandalous what's actually happening there, and they're getting away with it because it's not been reported in the media. It took the deaths of 9 internationals to get this into the media, and that, I mean, that's just showing, I mean, it's your passport that counts, it's not if you're a human being that counts, and that's the sad situation. I mean, what I'd love to see happening is the people here going out and spreading the word. Ireland has one of the biggest diasporas in the world. So not just spread it around Ireland. You have relations in every country in the world nearly at this stage. America, Canada, Australia, England. You get these people to form the Israeli embassies in these countries and get onto their MPs in them countries and get pressure put on them. It's no sense in, with say, Ireland. Ireland's a small country, and yes, we box way above our weight. But we need other countries to start to come in behind us. So if you get the Irish diaspora up and running and just say, listen, keep an eye on this. Watch what's happening there. Get in touch with the embassies. Get in touch with your MPs in these countries and see if something can happen. You will see then that things will start to change much quicker. And, I mean, it needs to happen sooner rather than later, because the longer this goes on, the more people that are dying in Gaza. There was, for us going into Gaza, that actually spent 3 months working on the port. And they were really excited. The Palestinians were really excited about this big flotilla coming. They were actually going to get aid, and these were going to be the first cargo ships ever to go into Gaza. Now, that's how big this whole thing was. They'd never seen a cargo ship before. They wouldn't even know how to operate it, how to open the hatches. And they had been doing all these training exercises. They even got small wooden boats and brought them out and set them on fire to see how they could put them out. I mean, this is, they'd done all this. The maritime police set up. They had got guys in wetsuits. This was going to be the diving team to check the undersides of the boat. And these guys were in wetsuits. They didn't even have the proper dive gear. They only had wetsuits and snorkels at that stage. And they were, I don't know if anybody spotted in the papers, but they were out training the other day, and 4 of them were shot dead. They were shot dead. That got about that much in the papers, and most people don't even know about it. Every page was still covering this, I mean, the massacre on the boats. But these 4 divers who were just, they were early 20s and their late teens, were shot dead. The Israelis were asked if they had any weapons. Well, we can't comment on that. Basically, when they kind of comment on it, means they didn't even have weapons on board them. They were just out training, trying to get a snorkeling team together for the port police. I mean, what's happening there is deplorable, and it's being got away with. Now, just before I finish, I want to talk about BDS. I'll break it down to the most simplest form of, would say, what BDS is. And everybody knows what that is. Everybody in this country, they know the significance of it. It's a potato with a They know the significance of that, right? That's an Irish potato. You buy that, the money stays in Ireland, it goes to an Irish farmer, it actually helps the Irish economy, it keeps the Irish economy going, right? And the taxes are from the farmer, it keeps everything else going. That's an Israeli potato. They look the same, they'll more likely taste the same, and they're more likely around the same price. You buy that one, the money from that leaves the European Union. It doesn't even stay inside the European Union, it goes to Israel. The taxes that's made on that goes to the Israeli government. Most of that will go to the Israeli army. So you're buying bullets for the Israeli army, you buy Israeli goods. And not only that, but the more of these that you buy, the more land that they're going to need. And where do you think they get the extra land from? The Palestinians. And they're very cute on when they do take farms. They usually just wait until pre-harvest, and they'll take the land just before the land is ready for harvest, so they didn't even have to work at it, and they can go in and take all the fruits of the farm. So just when you are in a shop, and you just look. It's not a big deal. Just look, and if you see Israeli, just refuse to buy it. That's it. I mean, it's a very simple thing. One person doing it makes a small difference. Everybody in this room doing it makes a bigger difference. And I mean, that was the same thing that happened in the 80s with South Africa. It started off with a couple of girls outside Dunn stores who were basically ignored for years, and eventually it started picking up pace more and more until basically the whole world was boycotting Israel, or boycotting South Africa. And that's what needs to happen again. Start small in your, with yourself, pass the word on to as many people as possible, and it will happen. And that's all I have to say. Thank you. I just one more small thing that I forgot to say. It was just a very curious thing. When the IDF,
the IDF,
when they actually start to question us in Ashdod, and they defile on us, the pictures that they actually had of us were all taken in Dundalk. So they are around.
I guess we all know that. Yeah, Israeli Mossad agents operate in Ireland and operate with Irish passports. even if our Minister for Foreign Affairs hasn't put it. Yeah, do you have your passports back yet?
Wait a bit,
on the questions and answers, we'll deal with that in a second. But first, before getting on to the questions and answers, I want to underline one thing that Fintan and Derek have said. When I was last in Palestine, I was chatting to a friend about the international solidarity movement. These are a group of activists that go out there to, as Derek say, help Palestinians farm their land, to act in a way as human shields and as witnesses. And she was saying, these people are important, but way more important is what happens when they go back home. Because way more important is what happens in your country. Because we know that the only way that Israel will change is if there's enough pressure put on it from abroad. So Palestinians want us to get properly active in our country. We can't all go on the flotilla, though I hope a lot of us will be going on the flotilla. We can't all go on the flotilla, but we can all get involved in boycott actions, in other activities. And on that level, a lot of us here have been involved. I want to thank everyone here for the work that we've done. And I also want to thank actually people who aren't here, because all around the country, and we've got about 19 local groups now around the country, and all around the country there has been demonstrations for Gaza, to break the siege of Gaza, and linking this in with the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns that we're running. So I'm going to open it up to question and answer in a second, but beforehand, a couple of announcements about the actions that you can get involved in.
This audio is a recording of the Irish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign public meeting, Gaza After the Flotilla, What Next? The speakers are Fintan Lane, who was on the Challenger 1, and Derek Graham, who was on the Rachel Corrie. The audio was recorded on the 12th of June 2010. The audio was recorded and edited by Andrew Flood for Indie Media Ireland and the WSM website. You'll find more audio and related articles at www.wsm.ie.